After numerous deadlines, Major League Soccer officials are promising a major announcement when they visit this Tuesday. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. That makes this a good time to check exactly what, as a community, we have agreed to. To discuss that, I'm joined by Patrick Brennan, who covers FC Cincinnati for the Cincinnati Enquirer, as well as Enquirer reporters Cameron Knight and columnist Jason Williams, who have covered different aspects of the interlocking deals that have brought the club, or we think, or is going to bring the club to Cincinnati. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Patrick, Cameron, great to have you here. Jason's running a little bit late, but we trust that he'll be here. He's heard about deadlines anyway. So anyway, Patrick, there is this major announcement that has been hinted at, put out there. Is there any doubt in your mind what's going to happen here on Tuesday?
Yeah, there's really none whatsoever, Dan. Taking the phrasing that FC Cincinnati and Major League Soccer officials used in their news releases yesterday to announce an announcement, you take the phrasing of it at face value, and it seems a little opaque, but the wording they've used is actually, it's for anyone that's followed Major League Soccer's expansion over even just the last 6 months, this wording, a significant soccer announcement, major soccer announcement, major announcement about the future of soccer in Cincinnati, this is all code phrasing for you're in. It's similar language was used for the expansion announcement in Nashville back in December, and the same was true of the announcement in Miami in late January. So just that part alone suggests to me very, very, very strongly that FC Cincinnati is going to get confirmation of them joining MLS on Tuesday, and then you combine that with all the other things that the organization does so well, just speaking to the sporting side of the organization exclusively, they've been operating on a major league scale in terms of ticketing and merchandising and certainly fan support, as we know, and even in terms of on-field results. So you combine what we know of FC Cincinnati with our analysis of the phrasing from the news releases yesterday. And for me, it all adds up to a pretty obvious situation and a pretty positive one.
Well, one question in my mind is do you think this is tied in any way to what the league may know about the future of the Columbus Crew and the possibility of them moving to Austin? Or does that actually even make any difference at this point?
I don't think it makes any difference at this point. I don't know that it's been truly relevant to the process as it pertains to Cincinnati at any point during the formal expansion process, which obviously began on January 31st of last year. The thing about the relationship between Cincinnati and Columbus is that a lot of people view that as a positive relationship because we know that Major League Soccer has emphasized regional rivalries. And when you can have a regional rivalry in an authentic way that really matters to the sporting cultures of two cities that geographically make sense, something Columbus has really struggled for throughout its history. In Major League Soccer, they really didn't have a natural geographic rival. I think the league tried to force some things with Toronto, with Columbus, and to a certain extent with the Chicago Fire organization. But what we saw in the U.S. Open Cup match between Columbus and Cincinnati last year was that right out of the gate, you had this incredible passion and zest for a rivalry that really just appeared out of thin air and happened by chance, by virtue of FC Cincinnati progressing in that competition. So I would tend to think that the FC Cincinnati reaching MLS would give MLS more pause to consider keeping the Columbus organization in Columbus.
Okay. Well, we'll see what happens. Cameron, you have, in this past week, done a article sort of digging into what are the, not just the numbers in terms of the financial commitment on the public dollar side, but what some of the implications of those numbers are. So what has the city committed? Where's it going to get that money from?
Well, the city's committed to a little over $30 million to finance stadium infrastructure, which is kind of a boring phrase, but it basically means they're not buying any parts of the stadium. They're just doing roads and utilities and things like that to support the stadium, parking, things like that. The interesting thing that we kind of dove into this last week was the $17 million that the team is going to receive from the hotel tax that our city has. There's a lot of little sections of the hotel tax. There's the county portion. There's the city portion. But basically, the hotel tax was sort of a lot of it has always been earmarked for convention centers, specifically Duke. Some of it is earmarked for Sharonville. There's this whole complex way that the hotel tax goes down, but more importantly is that it's bonded money. So the other parts of this deal, this $30 plus million, come from cash on hand, basically the sale of Blue Ash Airport, the Over the Rhine TIF, Over the Rhine and Downtown Tax District, $8 million is coming from that. It's basically cash on hand. But this money is going to be bonded against. So it's it's potentially a $1.5 million payment that the city is going to be making for the next 30 years.
$1.5 million per year.
Per year, annually, right. So over the course of 30 years, this $17 million essentially loan could cost the city $45 million, which is something that is not uncommon in the grand scheme of development. Like when we're going to issue bonds for anything, that's what it means. Anytime you hear the phrase issue bonds, it means the city's taking out, the Port Authority is taking out a loan on some future source of revenue, which in this case is the hotel tax. So there's a little bit of issue there with the money and how it's going to work out. And there was also there's this other little smaller slice of money that the city may be trying to get into the FC Cincinnati infrastructure pot as well, which could amount to as much as $7.5 million over the course of 30 years, which would be spent as like stopgap, basically to get the bonds to look better. It would be saying like, we'll throw in a little bit of extra money if that hotel tax doesn't reach the 1.5 mark in any given year. But that's not a done deal yet.
So are you saying that besides the interest that's going to have to be paid if they have to bond this, that this could have implications for available funds to expand the Duke Convention Center?
Well, the 250, there's this 200, the small slice I was referring to is $250,000 a year, which right now is earmarked for the Sharonville Convention Center. It goes to the county, the city pays it to the county, then the county allots it to debt service on the Sharonville Convention Center. And the city's asked for that back. They want it back, and they want to put it into this FC infrastructure pot of money just in case the hotel tax falls short in any given year. The larger implication is that in this – they call it a waterfall of taxes, like how the money is arranged. They say it's arranged in a waterfall. Some of the things that are slated for Duke Energy – are only going to happen if there's leftover money from the hotel tax. So if the hotel tax hits 1.5 or less, there's not going to be any money left over for Duke.
And did I read it correctly in your article that recently the hotel tax generate at $1.1 million?
Over the past several years, I'm not exactly clear on the span of time they've done that average, but over the past several years, the average yearly kind of revenue from this, again, this portion of the waterfall has been $1.1 million, yeah, which is you know, $400,000 less than they could potentially be giving every year. Now, granted, if it hits $1.1 million in 3 years, it doesn't mean that the city suddenly has to come up with extra money. It just means that that's how much money that is going to be given to the this infrastructure bond payment.
Overall, though, is it fair to say that there are implications by investing in FC Cincinnati and puts pressure on other projects?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, in the way that it's arranged, the way the funding arrangement is set up, Duke comes after the stadium in some ways.
So. Okay. So we have a question that has come in, and Jimmy, I think you have a question for us.
Yes, sir. How you doing, Dan?
I'm doing good.
Okay. Dan, here's my question. Of all the controversy that's going on about this FCC stadium down in the West End, being from the West End, I just wanted to ask the question of this. Knowing how we Cincinnatians are, and the blacks who came up from down south during the slavery release, and we were put over here in this area in the West End, that was where we raised up and raised our children. My question is, does the FCC, the city, or anybody in this elite understand the secrecy and the heartfelt digging up of our community, the dead souls of those Africans who are dead and buried there and made this land what it is, and the politicians and lawyers and doctors to come out of that land? Does it matter to them that for a dollar and a kickball stadium, does it matter?
Well, I think what, Jimmy, I think what you're raising here is the structure and the importance of the community benefits agreement. And Jason, you've written about that this week. How would you evaluate the community benefits agreement in terms of the concerns of the people of the West End?
Well, first of all, I think that's a really great question and concern that you've raised, Jimmy. And my thing is, and I wrote about this last week, is that I think we really need to have a bigger, broader conversation about, you know, gentrification, urban core redevelopment, bringing all different factions, groups, and residents, and developers, and everyone who has an interest together, and really try to establish a best practice moving forward. Because, Jimmy, I think, you know, that, you know, this is going to happen in some other neighborhood, and there's going to be some other Jimmy who's going to have this same concern, I think. And so I really think that the leadership in this town needs to address this. And you mentioned the community benefits agreement. That's potentially a way to do it. Developers are a little hesitant on those things to have them as a requirement, because it's such a competitive world, economic development, that if, you know, one roadblock can send your project elsewhere to Indianapolis or Charlotte or, you know, Liberty Township or Highland Heights or somewhere like that.
Well, given what you're saying, Jason, it sounds like at that particular moment, you're in agreement with somebody you've also criticized, and that's Michelle Dillingham, who points out that community benefits agreement, in a guest column in the Cincinnati Enquirer, mm-hmm. pointed out that the negotiations were just with one organization, unlike the project, the community benefits agreement in Los Angeles, which had 30 partners to it, that it was rushed and that there wasn't a good process.
Mm-hmm.
Are you essentially on that level agreeing with Michelle?
Well, I saw this one as I mean, those are certainly good things to bring up. This was and I know it sounds a little wishy-washy, but this was a unique situation in that it was the community council's executive committee that negotiated the original community benefits agreement, which technically, I guess, is one organization, but it is the organization that is representative of the neighborhood. And so, but, you know, I think it's a great point. I think we need to, you know, this is things that I even think of after the fact, is that, and Cameron wrote a really nice piece about community councils, is that, you know, this raises a question about what roles the community councils have. What does there need to be more structure there? Are they the true representative of the neighborhood? You know, we saw in this case that you could come right in on the fly and join it, you know, with a few bucks and then vote on this big, big issue. Well, I mean, to me, you would think there needs to be some kind of structure, like, okay, we're going to have an election. We're going to have 20 seats in our community council, and we're going to have an election once a year, once every 2 years. And these are the folks that represent every neighborhood. And so, you know, that's certainly something. And that's what I'm talking about, having that bigger, broader discussion.
I think those are significant points. And anybody who's lived in a city neighborhood and been active with a city, with a neighborhood council, mm-hmm. knows that these are not new issues, or nor are they West End issues.
Exactly.
These community councils really get life every time there's some proposal for change.
Well, and the important thing to remember about these community councils is that there's very little governing them in terms of how the city recognizes them. And they suffer from the exact same issues that the larger political system suffers from, which is it's hard to get people engaged. I mean, look at the primary results. Look at the voting numbers in midterm elections. I mean, that's for state offices. That's for city council races. I mean, the level of engagement on that, imagine how difficult it is to get someone to care about liquor permits and zoning changes. And I mean, there is a lack of just it's hard. It's a hard sell to get people to dedicate their time to something like that. And and then with that lack of engagement on some levels comes questions of who's actually running the thing.
And what's the legitimacy?
Right.
So
this is a great opportunity to get into much better health. I feel better. I feel much more energetic. All of the medical signs indicate that I am. And as a consequence of all this, I believe that I will be able to much, much better serve the people of Hamilton County, both the balance of this year and beyond. So I'm enjoying what I'm doing. I'm glad to be back.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Dan Hurley. That was Hamilton County Commissioner Todd Portune Wednesday night speaking at his first commission meeting since major surgery last month to amputate his left leg. At Cincinnati City Hall this week, the status of Jeff Pastor's campaign finances only gets murkier, while Councilmember Christopher Smitherman floated a suggestion that it's time to return to the two-year council terms. And Kentucky primary voters made their choices on candidates for the November ballot. To discuss tri-state politics this week, we're joined by Cincinnati regional politics reporter Scott Wortman and Cincinnati Enquirer columnist Jason Williams stays with us. To join our discussion, call 513-419-7100. Welcome, Scott. Thank you.
Thanks for having me back.
All right. It's fun on Fridays. Let's start with Todd Portune. I mean, Todd Portune, in my mind, is one of those good news, positive sorts of stories in terms of whether one agrees with Todd on a particular issue or not. Over the years, tremendous dedication and seeing things through, given some of his physical challenges.
Oh, absolutely. I've admired his toughness. I mean, he's had a lot thrown at him over the last 18 years or so. He's a former college track star, he became partially paralyzed about 15 years ago because of tumors and blood clots, bounced back from that, worked from his hospital bed. Then he was diagnosed a few months ago with cancer in his left leg, which had been paralyzed for the last 15 years, dealt with that, has only been out a month, but was working straight through that. I mean, he lost a leg and he's still teleconferencing in the meetings, and then within a month he's already back, and he's doing it with a smile on his face, and yeah, I mean it's very admirable.
Yeah, it's just amazing. Jason, do you interact with Todd a lot, I suspect?
Scott more so than me, and Scott's done a great job on covering this. It can be a sensitive, thing to cover when you're, dealing with such a personal issue. But Todd has such a positive attitude, as Scott said, that he takes the uncomfortableness of covering something like this out of it. What I would add is that I just have a lot of respect for him. I think what I like most is that he is a public figure in a role, and I think that he can be just show people like, hey, you can have all these hardships, but look, you can overcome them. And I think he's using his role in the public eye for the benefit to show people like, keep going, don't give up. And I know it sounds cliche, but he's truly is living it. Like it's not some big phony thing. Like,
no, it's just him day in and day out.
Absolutely.
And the post he wrote to announce that he was going to have that operation is one of the most amazing pieces I've ever read. You know, I'll be better off. I'll be able to walk better after losing.
He means it.
Yeah, I know he means it. I mean, that's the amazing thing.
Well, he was in his first meeting back too, even though he's minus a leg and he was in a wheelchair, he would stand up for the Pledge of Allegiance, stand up to greet people. So he's tough.
Yeah, he's tough, but he's a smiler and he's a worker. He has always been a worker. Let's move on. Jeff Pastor, not great new insights this week, but this issue just keeps bobbing along at City Hall without seemingly, what I'm confused by, Jeff Pastor getting a hold of it and trying to make a statement, clarify, deal with, whatever the right word here is.
Yeah, it's a little bit bizarre, but we live in bizarre political times, and so I think maybe he sees it as that way. Like, maybe I don't really have to make a statement or tell anybody, that I just continue to do what I'm doing. The people elected me. And, I'm here fair and square as it seems at this point. I'll point out, and it's in fairness, that there's been nothing unethical or illegal that's been found. I don't even want to use the word yet necessarily, because ultimately right now, a lot of this stuff does not look good. It doesn't smell good. It raises a lot of questions, but right now that's all things are. There's a lot of questions with no answers.
The area that is most problematic are the financial reports to the Board of Election,
yes,
which are totally out of line. And somebody, maybe it was you, but somebody pointed out this week, maybe Sharon pointed this out, that other people had issues that had to be corrected on their reports. That's not uncommon. Those are complicated. But everybody else is taking care of them. And none of them were big. These are big issues about where this money was spent and where it came from. And that is troubling to me.
Yeah, I very much so. And that was Sherry that had a nice piece on that. Really kind of the last few months I've been thinking a lot about this is, I feel like there needs to be stiffer penalties for when the rules aren't followed on things like this. Now, as of right now, there's really no mechanism that says you're going to be fined and that's going to come out of your pocket. Right now there's an open meetings issue going on with the text message at City Hall. Well, in the end, it's the taxpayers that have to foot the bill. So where is the real, personal accountability on the people who are, breaking the rules or potentially breaking the rules?
Well, so where does Christopher Smitherman's proposal, basically saying, there's no recall in the Cincinnati Charter.
Correct.
So, and we now have 4-year terms. I'm not sure this is exactly why Christopher Smitherman's proposing this, but the point is, he's saying we ought to go back to 2-year terms. That this means that people are acting and doing things and hoping that people forget 4 years from now what they did.
It's interesting. Like I understand the argument that I think if you'd asked Christopher right now that he was never in favor of 4-year terms, I'm not exactly sure exactly where he stood on that, but that's just my hunch. You know, it's interesting. I brought this up the other day to someone in the office that I didn't hear anybody talking about the need to go back to 2-year terms during the first 4-year term from 2013 to the end of 17. Yes, things have been really wild so far at City Hall through 5 months. It's still really in the grand scheme a pretty small snippet of the term. Maybe give it a year, maybe, and then see where you're at. There's a lot of concern. I think underneath this is there's a concern from the mayor's office that you've got a moderate pro-development, pro-growth, pragmatic approach going on from the mayor and the vice mayor. And then you have this uber progressive agenda going on. And, you know, I think I wrote about this last week that if Michelle Dillingham had gotten elected over Pastor, that we would be seeing that agenda. So that really determined the line. And so I think looking ahead, Smitherman's looking at running for mayor. And so he's concerned about what is that council going to look like if I win mayor?
Well, you know, I want to challenge you on the column that you wrote about Michelle Dillingham.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it that you don't think that she speaks for a legitimate group of people who need a voice in the community, that being progressive makes her ideological as opposed to conservative being ideological? I mean, there's a lot of terms thrown around there that when I read your column, it was like,
I don't see I wasn't taking a stand on the political aspect of it one side or the other, but I do see I don't see a lot of ideological views coming from the, I get, you know, for lack of a better phrase, the pro-Cranley coalition. I am seeing a lot of ideological, you know, stuff coming from the other side. I'm not saying that's good or bad. I'm just saying, like, and I raised in the, I really didn't put my opinion in the column. I just sort of, hey, here was what could have happened had Michelle Dillingham been elected. And I even raised the question, I'm like, you know, with 223 votes and all the money that Pastor had that's questionable, you know, is this really representative of what the city wanted? Or did they want that progressive majority?
Yep. Well, I want to move on to a couple of other things. Scott, one thing was the Kentucky primaries.
Yes.
And when it comes to the two judge executives, incumbents won pretty much as we expected. On the question of the 4th congressional district, who was going to challenge Thomas Massie? And it comes out, yeah, it's Seth Hall.
Yes. And no one in Northern Kentucky knows who he is. A lot of people, a lot of Democrats in Northern Kentucky were pretty shocked by that because Patty Piott, who is a Bellevue resident, worked in the food service industry. This was her first run at office. She ran a very credible campaign.
Came in second.
And she had a high visibility in the Northern Kentucky counties, which she won easily. But the problem was she didn't really go anywhere else. It's a 20-county district, and Seth Hall won every other county. And so he will be facing Thomas Massie. But really, I mean, it's kind of cold comfort because it was a competition on who was going to lose to Thomas Massie. There's really nobody credible sees him losing in such a staunchly conservative district.
I think we can say that the 4th district leans Republican.
It's safely Republican, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's not spend any more time on that. the fact that Linda Talley Smith,
yes,
lost basically 2-1,
mm-hmm,
against David Dooley, any surprise to you there?
I don't think so. Republicans in her own party had called for her to resign over the past year. And it was a story that was more than just political because one of the most high-profile murder cases in the region was overturned because of some questions on whether she should have turned over evidence to the defense, She admitted an affair with the lead detective in the case after the trial. So it was a mess.
It was a mess.
But she refused to resign and was like, well, I'm going to make you beat me. And so they did.
Yeah, pretty easily. The other thing that you wrote about this week is the proposals for the banks, the music venues for the banks. And you did some comparative work between the Cincinnati Symphony Orchestra proposal and particularly the Pro West proposal, the group out of Columbus.
Yes.
Seeing that because the third competitor in this is asking for significant city tax dollars, and that probably isn't in the cards.
Yes.
So you focused on these two. How did you what did you see? How did you see that balance coming out?
It's gotten pretty contentious, which kind of took me by surprise. People across the city and a lot of music fans have strong feelings on it. The establishment, a lot of the older elected leaders, they know the people on the CSO board. They like the CSO. But a lot of music promoters and music fans here, they think Promo West will bring in younger acts, basically because the CSO owns Riverbend and the Taft, and a lot of the programming for that, I mean, that's a much bigger venue, kind of skews older. And the CSO says, no, we have contacts with the we just haven't had the venue to book a lot of these younger acts that they want, and this will give us the venue.
Promo West does Bunbury, right?
Yes. And they also have venues in Pittsburgh and Columbus, which book a lot of like young current acts. Yeah.
So when you get down to size, fit onto to the banks, design, where did you think things – what were the strengths of CSO? What were the strengths of Promo West?
Well, the Symphony's proposal is much more compact, which would save a lot of development space for other uses. And they would finish out the last part of Smail Park, which they would use for outdoor concerts in the summer. The Promo West and then the third promoter, which has pretty much been discounted, Live Nation, because they're the ones asking for the public money, they're a lot bigger structures. So a lot of the people that are the decision makers, they like the CSO's design better because it saves money and it's a bit more inconspicuous. So
and gives them a parcel of property they can develop another way.
Yes.
Which means more income.
Yes.
On another side. What's the time frame on this?
Well, the original time frame, I mean, there isn't really actually a deadline, but I mean, they had hoped when they were putting out the bids, asking for proposals, they hope to have a venue open by the end of next year, 2019, have it up and running.
So that was pretty aggressive and needed fairly quick decision.
Yeah, well,
to get something
definitely
going.
The property owners, the business owners at the banks would definitely like something sooner rather than later because the foot traffic there hasn't met expectations.
So getting Todd Portune, to get back to the first part of this discussion, getting Todd Portune back at the commission so that that vote can be taken is probably pretty important.
Oh, most definitely. And he's going to be back at the meetings this coming week. So
And the meetings will be back at the county.
Yes.
They don't have to come to the hospital to meet
exactly.
To meet
no,
Todd
he's back full time. And he said they will be discussing this on the first meeting back. So.
All right. The Cincinnati Streetcar has two purposes: to provide transportation in the Central Business District and over the Rhine, and to drive development along that route. Understanding how to balance these two goals underlies all the discussion about the streetcar, including the proposal this week by David Mann to stop collecting fares. To examine this proposal and also a proposal by Greg Landsman, we are joined by transportation and mobility reporter with WCPO Television, Pat LaFleur. And to join the discussion, call 513-419-7100 or email us at talk@wvxu.org. And we are also on Facebook and Twitter. Welcome back, Pat.
Thank you for having me, Dan.
This is an interesting proposal. Let's take on the sort of straightforward David Mann proposal first of eliminating the fare.
Yes.
That isn't unique.
It's not unique. It's also kind of counterintuitive, and I think that was most people's initial reaction. Well,
you know, young guys like Dave Mann, they think of things out of the box, counterintuitive.
Sure. So you're right that Cincinnati is not alone in considering making their streetcar kind of urban connector loop free. Probably the closest comparison we have is Kansas City, and they opened their streetcar only a few months before we did. It's a very similar structure, very similar route, identical vehicles, in fact. And they opened their streetcar in the spring of 2016 and haven't charged a single cent for anyone to use it. And their ridership is astronomical. It's between 1 and 2 million rides a year.
As opposed to what's ours?
Less than 500,000 a year.
So more than double.
Yes. Yes.
More significantly more than double.
Actually. Yeah. And the fare collection has been a thorn in the streetcar side since its launch in September of 2016. The fare boxes were malfunctioning for almost a year. It took about 12 months for that issue to be resolved. Credit cards weren't working. People didn't understand how to validate their tickets after they purchased them. It was just a frustrating process for everybody.
The software was not intuitive, as we say.
Correct, yes.
Okay, so is that – when David Mann talks that it cost about $125,000 a year to collect the fares, is that including the money it takes to service all of those fare boxes?
From what I understand, it's – everything that goes into the process. So it's servicing the fare boxes, but it's also paying the fare monitor personnel who ride the streetcar to check to make sure that people have paid. Now, I get mixed reviews on how often those fares are checked, but the industry standard is that about 20% of riders are asked to demonstrate that they've paid.
Have you ever been on the streetcar and seen anybody checked?
I have.
I've never seen that.
And that's what I hear most is that no one's ever seen it. But again, it only happens about theoretically about 20% of the time or less.
So given that, is there any estimate about how many people are riding for free now?
You know, I haven't explored that. I would imagine that there is a significant portion of people who get – and especially people who are visiting the city and using it, they might not even know that they have to pay for it.
A number of systems, the one in Detroit – I happen to be in Detroit on business the weekend that the Detroit streetcar started.
Right.
It went for 6 or 7 months not charging fare to get people used to riding it.
Sure.
Then they started introducing fare, and they lost about 40% of their ridership when they introduced the fare.
Right.
When I was in Portland, I don't know, 18 years ago, the streetcar didn't charge in the downtown area.
That's a very common practice to open it free.
Yeah, and it's not unusual just to keep these. So where would the money come if you're not going to get it from the fare box? Where does David Mann think that the money is going to come from? Because we need income.
Well, David Mann wants to create what he's calling a parking trust fund. And that money would come from developers along the streetcar route in downtown and OTR who – any developer who's willing to contribute to this fund – the requirements that currently exist for developers to provide parking infrastructure around their properties, they would be allowed to pay 40% of that cost into the parking trust fund in exchange for having looser rules about what kind of parking they need to provide. So he's hoping that that would generate a little more than $300,000 a year from developers, and that would theoretically fill that gap that we would lose from collecting fares.
You know, people don't realize frequently how expensive it is in the center of an urban area to develop structured parking. Now, I'm not sure about surface if you just tear down a building and or there's a vacant lot next to your development. But in a structured parking garage, it can be $20,000 to $1,000 per space.
Per space, yes.
Is what you're talking about. So it's very expensive.
Astronomical, the cost.
So he believes that you would get developers to pay into this fund, and that would offset what we would lose from fares. That would drive ridership, which is good for the developers and for businesses along the route.
Exactly. And that's to the point that you made at the beginning of this segment, that it's about balancing the streetcar as a transportation tool versus an economic development tool. And what David Mann hopes is that he can rely on the wave of development support that has already been established. There have been millions and millions of dollars
and
invested
in OTR
already.
If you look at that data rather than ridership data, because people are used to thinking, well, this is a transportation vehicle only rather than a development vehicle. If you look at the development side and the number of developments, both in OTR but also in the CBD and down in the banks,
right,
where developers have said, we're interested in this parcel because the streetcar goes past it, then you begin to look at the economic impact of streetcar very differently.
That's exactly right. And the problem that the streetcar faces right now is that the optics of seeing an empty streetcar running around downtown and OTR and the banks is what people notice most. Right. They don't necessarily see the slower game of developing the property along the streetcar route. So it's a real challenge for the city to demonstrate the money that's been pumped into these neighborhoods because of the streetcar when ridership is low and, you know, people visiting downtown maybe once, twice, three times a year, they come down and see a streetcar that has three, four people on it when it's designed to hold almost 200. That's a hard image to fight.
Right. Just to go back and pick up something that I should have asked. If a person gets on a streetcar, doesn't have a validated ticket, so they're riding without paying.
Right.
What's the fine, or is there a fine?
It's $100 the first offense, and then it goes up $100 the second time, and then up another $100 the third time. And I don't know if it goes beyond $300. I haven't asked.
I don't want to know if it goes beyond $300.
Well, and that's the funny thing is that it's so expensive to ride the streetcar without a ticket if you're caught, but parking on the streetcar line is a $50 ticket. It's half the cost of
Parking on the streetcar.
When you park on the streetcar route, I apologize, parking on the tracks.
Which is one of our big problems.
Yes.
We have that slows the street. Well, it stops the streetcar, mm-hmm. and getting people to get them re-educated so they don't do that,
right,
is a big part. Let's shift over to the proposal that Greg Landsman, who is the chair of the Major Projects Committee, and the streetcar falls under Greg's purview.
That's right.
And he has put out this outline of a proposed reform of the management of the streetcar. What are the essential elements of that?
So this came up last year when Transportation Committee Chair Amy Murray pointed out that, you know, we have a lot of cooks in this kitchen. We've got the city who owns a streetcar. We have the Transit Authority, SORTA, that oversees streetcar operations. And then we have a third-party contractor carrying out the operations. They're called Transdev, yes.
Right.
And so there are so many people who could be held accountable for this. And I think what Greg Landsman wants to see, he wants to see that consolidated into a single executive director role that would be supported by all of those agencies, as well as another nonprofit organization that would be formed to help kind of coordinate all of those efforts. So it's about having one person to answer all of the many questions that everyone has about the streetcar.
He wants a Harry Truman.
Yes, he does. That's exactly right.
Where the buck stops on that person's desk, and who has the big picture of all the potential funding sources, whether it's this parking idea, whether it's better sales of advertising, promotions, all of that kind of stuff that could go in. So a cleaner structure with a single person to head this thing up.
Yes, that's the gist.
He's also in that plan saying, I really want this traffic study that we say
we've been waiting.
We're working on, right?
You know, when it was first authorized by city council, it was supposed to come out this spring. Mm-hmm. It's now been pushed back to the fall. And I haven't gotten a straight answer on what the delay is, but we really need it, not just for the streetcar, but for cars. Walnut Street, Main Street are nightmares in the afternoon rush for drivers, for pedestrians. I'm a cyclist. I bike through it every day. It's a nightmare.
So do you know who's got that contract to do the traffic study? The city's not doing it themselves.
The name is escaping me, but it is a third-party contractor who's doing it for them.
And they're delayed.
Yes.
But is there any explanation? Is it because they don't have the data being provided to them, or is it because something else?
I haven't gotten a good answer on it.
Traffic studies are done in lots of places, and they're not mysteries about how to do them.
Well, and this, keep in mind, this is specifically a traffic signal study. It's supposed to look specifically at the timing, and I really don't know what the holdup is on it, but at the same time, that's kind of the way that local government operates. You know, they'll say that something is going to be ready now, and then it's ready then instead.
What about all the complaints that have arisen about the cars themselves, the mechanical problems that now
of the streetcar vehicles?
Yeah, I really don't have much patience with the fact that we had an ice storm and.
Kansas City gets ice storms too, and they didn't seem to have these issues.
They didn't?
No.
We did have to close down Suspension Bridge because of the ice storm.
That's true, yes.
Yeah, and that's not new technology. That's old technology.
Right.
That's 1867 technology. But what about some of the other stuff? There are lots of seemingly difficult problems.
So the biggest problem, and CAF is the manufacturer. They're based in Spain. But they do have a headquarters in New York. They manufacture the vehicles for both us and Kansas City. They're the newest vehicles that have been designed for this kind of system. In our case, for some reason, multiple vehicles had issues with compressors that helped convey the vehicles down the tracks. And the cold weather caused them to basically malfunction. I think they might have even just cracked and burst. Something to do with cold air and the pressure. I'm no physicist nor am I an engineer, so I don't know how to do – I don't know any of this kind of science-y stuff. But I know that it was one particular component that kept malfunctioning, and they had to get them replaced. And as far as I know, I haven't heard any sign that Kansas City has had that problem.
Well, Pat, thanks for being with us today. Keep riding the streetcar. Come back with more answers.
Appreciate it. You've been listening to
Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. Selena Reeder is our assistant producer. Lila Shakui is our intern. Our technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are available on our website, wvxu.org. I'm Dan Hurley.